Gallup. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we take a closer look at public opinion across sub-Saharan Africa and how the pandemic has impacted lives across the continent. Magali Rowe and Jay Lotchke are Gallup's regional directors for sub-Saharan African nations. Together, for the past decade, they've used the Gallup World Poll to track how citizens are evaluating their own lives across the continent. Jay, Magali, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mohammed. Always a pleasure to join you on the podcast.
Thanks, Mohammed. Thanks for having me.
Jay, let me start with you. You both really have managed to gather data in some of the hardest places. How was this year's pandemic different than other years for you and your teams across the continent? How did it unfold differently as this COVID was kind of tearing the world apart?
Wow. Well, I mean, it's been a year unlike any other, truthfully. The whole year was really just a scramble once things kind of kicked off as they did in March. Just to give you kind of an idea of how unprepared in some ways we were, even though we had done a lot of research that did, I think, end up preparing us for this year. And like a lot of industries and a lot of companies, you know, no one was ready for what hit us. I was actually in the client in Africa, in Ethiopia and Tanzania, with a couple of clients at the very end of February 2020, only a couple of weeks before everything really kicked off. And as I was in the field with those clients, I think the main things that we were really concerned about was, you know, the nuances of how random route procedure would happen in the field. You know, would people knock on the right doors, and maybe a dozen other kind of similar types of things. You know, a global pandemic was way down the list. That wasn't even something that was in our mind. And this was only about 2 weeks before we had to cancel that entire project altogether, just to show you how fast things kind of unraveled. I recall seeing people at the airport wearing masks and that sort of thing, and still feeling like it was kind of strange. We knew that COVID was out there. It was something that we thought was mainly kind of relegated to China at that time. We knew it was kind of creeping out, but we never really thought it would get in the way of field work. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, you know, Tom Hanks gets COVID, and the Utah Jazz are escorted off the court, games are canceled, and President Trump is addressing the country in the Oval Office, kind of giving us an idea of what's to come. And at that same time, Gallup started to pull back some of its employees that were traveling abroad at that time. So we weren't really ready, unfortunately. We are very heavily face-to-face. Most of World Poll and a lot of other of our projects are face-to-face based, because face-to-face is really the gold standard of doing this type of survey research in a lot of the world, and a lot of the developing world in particular, where Magali and I work. You know, projects are entirely face-to-face. We've never done a survey by phone. We've never done a survey by web. So when COVID hit, really, we were thrown off guard so much. We waited for probably about 3 months, just trying to see how things would settle down, whether or not we'd be able to go back into the field before we really put together, I think, a solution so that we could move all of Africa over to phone. And luckily, Gallup had a lot of experience in Western Europe and in highly developed countries in Asia, where we kind of had the background to know how to make something work. And we started to create that solution, and actually created a solution that did work pretty well for Africa, considering that these types of surveys had never been done there ever before.
Magali, what would you add to that?
So I was also traveling for a client project at the end of February. I was in Senegal, and I could see how things were unfolding, where at the beginning of the training week, we just had a few cases of COVID in the country. And then by the end of the training week, the number of cases had grown exponentially. So I could see how things were unfolding and how that was going to probably impact our ability to do face-to-face surveys in Africa. I would also add that the solution that we ended up, you know, using, developing, building, you know, it took a lot of work, but and it was very much, it felt very much like an R&D process. It was almost like, okay, we now need to build a plane while we need to fly the plane at the same time. So fasten your seatbelt, because it's going to get really busy really fast. And basically, what we ended up doing was a feasibility evaluation of countries that could be switched from face-to-face mode to telephone mode. So we looked at basically the availability of telephone frames for the countries that we work in. We looked at the number of cell phone subscribers. We looked at whether we could use a dual frame, landline and telephone. In most of sub-Saharan Africa, it was mainly mobile phone frames. And so we had to build an entire infrastructure beyond having, you know, the frame, the telephone frame, working on the respondent selection, but actually building basically the telephone application, the telephone software to make it possible for us to do surveys in a very rigorous manner, because that was not what we had to do. Was not an experiment. It was the real thing. It had to work. So the rigor behind the methodology had to be there as well. So the building of the telephone survey platform was certainly very challenging, but it had to go through several iterations and testing. There were still a lot of bugs. We ended up having to do a lot of troubleshooting, but the whole team came together. So starting with the smaller core Whirlpool team, extending to the larger Whirlpool team, and of course, our teams on the continent of local partners, interviewers, supervisors, validators, everybody really came together. And I would say that if there was one team that could orchestrate and build this kind of switch from face-to-face to telephone, this was it. It was really the Gallup Whirlpool team.
And it's for those listening, it sounds like, wow, that sounds really technical and complicated. I just wanted to give our listeners an insight into what it really takes to pull off not only a poll, but a global survey that is the source for the World Happiness Report, financial inclusion data, given the year of that we're in, trust in science, modern day slavery, all these things that we help global organizations measure. You two basically were asked to figure out how to do that in a pandemic. And it's just phenomenal to hear kind of how it all came together. Let me ask you, Jay, looking at the data you gathered itself or themselves, what were some of the key findings from this year around the pandemic itself? What were some of the things that really struck you in the data you gathered?
Sure. Well, if you don't mind, I'd say first, you know, we've been collecting relevant types of data in approach of this pandemic for years, right? We've been asking about healthcare systems. We've been asking about whether or not people have certain types of health problems, about their own well-being. So we knew a lot about, preparedness, I think, for this type of thing all around the world before it even happened. And actually, back in 2018, we worked with a partner of ours, the Wellcome Global Monitor, that did a lot of work specifically even on vaccines, finding that sub-Saharan Africa had a really high rate of trust in vaccines. Sub-Saharan Africans believe that vaccines work, that they're safe. And that most people believe that they're also very important for children to have. I want to say it was something like 90% in Eastern Africa said that vaccines are effective. And that's a lot higher than a lot of the developed world, actually. A lot of Eastern Europe, for sure, much lower. Even parts of Western Europe are lower than what we've seen in sub-Saharan Africa. So we actually were coming from a base where I think people were kind of trusting to some, even if they didn't fully understand it, kind of trusting the science behind vaccines and that medicine was something that was going to help this situation, right? Even compared to fully developed countries. And I think part of that we could say is probably related to the fact that, you know, a lot of people in sub-Saharan Africa are not unaccustomed to living with infectious diseases. You know, yellow fever pops up, dengue fever, malaria is a leading cause of death. In the United States and in Western Europe, these are oftentimes things that we only read about at this point. They're things from the past. You know, people haven't actually seen a child with measles. So it could almost make sense that people in some rich countries might almost think, take for granted, I guess, what modern medicine has given them. You know, my grandmother was born in 1914. She had two siblings die at a very young age of diphtheria. And today, no one dies of diphtheria.
Never even heard of it.
Exactly.
Vaccines, makes the point.
Yes, exactly. Vaccines were created in the 1940s. We went from something like 45 deaths per 100,000 at the turn of the century to the late 1940s, it was almost zero. So thankfully, you know, for my grandmother's grandchildren, this isn't something we really have to deal with anymore. But in a lot of African countries, people still really appreciate what vaccines can do. So I would say that's where we started. How did that actually weather having COVID, given the politics of COVID, given the conspiracies of COVID? I would say that for the most part, those strong beliefs in you know, science and vaccines was pretty durable. I want to give one example, which was in Tanzania. President John Magufuli was very much in the news over the last year or so as being someone who was kind of a COVID denier in some ways, right? There were no lockdowns in Tanzania. He was never seen with a mask. He actually had commented at one point that COVID had been beaten back by prayer in Tanzania, and it was essentially a non-issue. Later on, it actually appears that he may have succumbed to COVID himself. He passed away a month or two back with a lot of reports saying it was actually COVID was why he died. So in 2018, we asked Tanzanians about whether or not they thought vaccines were important for children to have. 97% of Tanzanians said yes. So how did that strong belief do when you have your president, who's very popular, railing against, you know, any kind of COVID precautions? It's a different question, but last year, 79% of Tanzanians still said that if they had access to a COVID vaccine, they would take it. It's a different question than what we asked 2 years ago, but I think it still shows in that country, in Oslo, in a lot of East Africa, if not Africa in general, despite, I think, whatever complications and conspiracies there are, there is still a lot of support for the science that's kind of going to bring people out of this darkness. And it's unfortunate that only 1 or 2% of people in a lot of African countries have had the opportunity to be vaccinated.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that, Jay. It's such a great example, first of all, and it is remarkable to think about the willingness that the data highlight vis-a-vis the disparity of access that we're now seeing. And of course, the World Health Organization and many of the United Nations and others are now putting more pressure on developed economies to contribute more to providing access to the vaccine to more people in developing economies. Magali, what were some of the data findings that really struck you from this year?
Sure. So on the vaccination item, I would like to add that for me, what I see in the data is a tale of two Africas. So in many countries, especially in Eastern and Southern Africa, there's a lot of support for vaccination specifically against COVID-19. In many other countries, mainly in Western and Central Africa, it's the acceptance or the desire to be vaccinated is more muted. And so I was really intrigued by this because it's really like almost like a tale of two Africas where, like Jay very clearly articulated, there's normally when you ask questions, more general questions about vaccine acceptance, we do see that in Africa, people are far more likely than, say, in Western Europe to say that they trust the vaccine, that it is important, but it's more in, you know, more general terms. Once you reframe the question and specifically focus on COVID-19, what really struck me was this regional, sub-regional difference. And so, you know, I was asking more anecdotally my connections across the countries where I work. And some of the information that they shared with me is, I think, you know, provides a little bit of insight. So one of the things that I heard was that last year when people, when Africans wanted to go to and be tested, basically many of them were turned away or we don't have any more tests. come back tomorrow, come back in a couple of days. And so now they hear that there is a vaccine available, and they're wondering how something as sophisticated as a vaccine against a pandemic could have been basically put together in a very short amount of time. So there's some suspicion or a little bit of pause as to whether this is, this vaccine would really work against this disease. So a fair amount of skepticism. But also a lot of the populations in those Western and Central African countries may want to see an example from their very top political leadership, basically leading by example, and presidents showing publicly that they are accepting the vaccine, they're getting vaccinated themselves, and not only getting the vaccine themselves, but also having their families vaccinated. And that is what I'm hearing, that people want in those countries to feel maybe a little more comfortable about accepting the vaccination against COVID-19. That was one main key, data difference that I could see in this specific vaccination item. The other very interesting data finding for me was looking and comparing the findings from sub-Saharan Africa to developed countries on the economic front. So asking people about whether they had had to stop work temporarily during the pandemic, they had lost the ability to earn a living, they earned less money, lost a job, lost a business, you could see that it was almost like the mirror image of the data that we saw in developed countries. So to me, it spoke more about the importance of the informal economy in sub-Saharan Africa, where you would have 60% plus of respondents who say that, yes, they had to stop temporarily work or had lost wages, compared to, say, 30% in developed countries. So that was something that was very striking for me. And that was basically across the board in all the countries where we surveyed in 2020.
Jay.
Mohammed, I do want to add one kind of key point, I think, from my perspective, in terms of how COVID goes forward in Africa, right? We collected a lot of great data this past year, and we've collected a lot of great data in the past that informs this. But one thing we're seeing right now is with the variant in India, for example, there were a lot of arguments, I think, in India that were similar to what we had in Africa before, not always fully scientific explanations for why COVID didn't take off as much as people thought, even though the healthcare system's very poor in India. People live in very densely populated cities. Why didn't it take off in India? There were people who seemed to think that maybe there was almost some kind of natural immunity, right, from exposure to other types
of disease. Yes, there were very reputable periodicals that right. kind of alluded to that Indians had some sort of unique immune system capacity right. to fight off the disease.
Right. So that was something that was a very common explanation, I think. That now we're seeing that eventually India got hit anyway, and there are a lot of people who are expecting or at least fearing that potentially that kind of thing could eventually come to Africa as well, because a lot of the explanations for what insulated India and maybe insulated Africa appear to be sort of collapsing now. Even as, in the United States, we start to get our lives back somewhat, vaccination is so slow, and now India has actually ban the export of a lot of vaccinations through COVAX that we're going to go to Africa. So now the vaccination systems, it's going to be even slower than what it was before. And again, only 1 or 2% of people in a lot of African countries have had the ability to get a single dose. I just want to say, both India and Africa, when we asked people about how often they're able to wash their hands, South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa fare the worst. And we know that COVID is generally passed along through, you know, respiratory rather than through surface. You know, I think early on there were a lot of people who were concerned that there was a lot of surface spread. That may not be the case. It's still part of it in hand washing, unfortunately, in Africa, due to lack of hygienic facilities. It's something that's quite a bit lacking there. So if we do get a situation where we get a variant that could be highly contagious that comes to Africa, that's something that's working against it. We do have a high percentage of people in Africa, relatively speaking, who say that they have health problems that prevent them from doing things that people their age can do. There's a lot of people who have comorbidities and pre-existing you know, cases that might actually put them in a very bad situation for when one of these variants eventually do show up in their country. There was a Lancet study very recently that showed that although the mortality rate in Africa is not extremely high, among people who actually end up in the ICU, it's 50%. It's higher than in wow. most of the world. So if you get a severe case of COVID in Africa, your chances are actually quite a bit worse. And there are a lot of people who have those types of pre-existing conditions in Africa now. Also, the five countries in the world who say they are least satisfied with their healthcare systems are all based in Africa. Africans are less likely than most around the world to say that they're satisfied with their healthcare system. There are very few respirators. I think when COVID first sort of kicked off a year ago, Sierra Leone had 13 respirators in the entire country. The Central African Republic had 3. Now, I'm not sure if that situation has changed, but I doubt it's changed much. Sub-Saharan Africa has 0.2 physicians per 1,000 people compared to 2.9 in OECD countries. So the infrastructure, the healthcare infrastructure is very poor. People's health until now is not necessarily always great. And again, people kind of lack sometimes, unfortunately, even the information or the ability to kind of take care of themselves, living in densely populated cities oftentimes when COVID comes through. So right now, we're just hoping that we don't have a situation like what's kind of happened in India at this point. COVID's kind of going up and going down country to country, but that's sort of the fear.
Yeah, those are just really, really important points, Jay. And only to compound onto that, when you have societies, communities that actually do have trust in vaccines but don't have access, it only creates, you know, more frustration, more of a kind of political dynamic to what is really a potential public health disaster, as we're seeing in India. Soon on the podcast, we're actually going to have someone you both know very well and work with closely, Rajesh Srinivasan, to really do a deep dive on what's happening in India. But this is such a great segue to really what I want to close with you both on. To do this work, you both have been working with local partners for years now across the countries of focus for each of you. Tell us about what it was like to work with those partners and those teams as they themselves were personally managing the disruption of COVID and now being asked to imagine a new way to pull the continent. Jay, why don't you start?
Well, I would say first, some of our very close partners have experienced loss in their own families. So it's something that has hit, you know, very close to home, and that's not specific just to Africa. Certainly our partners at Gallup all around the world, we've seen suffer from this. But some of my very close partners in Africa have had that happen, unfortunately. I would actually kind of take perhaps an unexpected view and say, rather than being something that could be potentially extremely difficult for our partners in Africa, a lot of them actually transitioned very quickly. The technological adaptations we've seen across World Pole have taken on very, very quickly in Africa, actually. And sometimes our African partners have almost been kind of in the vanguard of a lot of the changes we've seen. So we might have expected that moving from a fully face-to-face model to a phone model in countries that have never had to use the types of apps and technology they had to use last year, we might have expected that would be tough. I would actually say that our partners adapted very quickly. And that's something that I think Africans probably don't get nearly enough credit for. And, you know, work from home is now an African thing too. We had interviewers who were unable to come to call centers because of local regulations, didn't want to put too many people in one room, who actually were taking calls remotely with supervisors listening in or listening to recordings after the fact. So I think actually, you know, the adaptation was great. And I think we can be very proud of a lot of the work that we did this past year. It was a great time to have data. Think about how many things COVID affected in the past year. Well-being, employment, approval of leadership. It would have been a shame to not have data in that crucial moment. And I'm really proud that the Gallup team and also our African partners were able to come together and put together a technical solution the way they did and make sure that we didn't have a missing data point on that now 16-year trend.
Yeah, that was, we were all staying up late. What are we going to do? There's going to be a whole... Magali, what were your experiences, things that really popped to the surface in the very hard work you were doing with your partners across the countries you're focused on?
I am 100% convinced that I was working with the right partners, the right team players. I was so very impressed with their ability to embrace change. Just like Jay said, all of our local teams adapted relatively quickly, considering what the ask was, which was almost like the Everest of survey research that you have to climb in a very short amount of time. There were, I did want to say that it's true that in sub-Saharan Africa, they have been historically very quick to embrace change. And it was actually the first region of the Worldpool project where we developed a CAPI, administering surveys using a mobile device compared to all other regions of the world. So there is a big appetite to embrace technology and to be at the forefront of, you know, anything that can make the survey process better, richer. So that was just an awesome experience to know that everybody was in it and that they were not going to give up. There were a lot of technology issues, but I knew that we could overcome that. I made myself available pretty much 24/7 to answer any questions, to provide the support that my local teams needed. And that worked because they had lots and lots of questions about the telephone platform that we were building. Things were breaking down, but you know, it's okay. You're going to pick up, get up again, and you're going to do it again. And I do remember that. I mean, I had to do 34,000 interviews and I had essentially 3 months to do it. And it was the end of September, and my main local partner, who is an absolutely awesome, awesome research project manager, called me at the end of September, and she said, you know, it's still not working. We can't get a single interview completed. And I said, don't worry, you know, between now and the end of the week, try to get just one, just do one interview, one, and that's going to be just awesome. And so this was like the motivation, the support, the encouragement that the teams needed. And she did it. She did one interview. She called me. She was just so excited. She had to share the news. I said, one to go. And then we have 34,000 minus one to go. And it worked and we did it. And it really was, I feel very strongly about this, the partners throughout the continent that we have put, the network that we have put together to help us do this amazing mode switch.
Of course, the work continues. You both are now knee waist deep in 2021. Data collection. Magali Rowe and Jay Lotchke are Gallup's regional directors for sub-Saharan African nations. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mohammed.
That's our show. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe and stay up to date with our latest conversations, just search for the Gallup Podcast wherever you podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us on Twitter at Gallup News. If you have suggestions for the show, email podcast@gallup.com. The Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.